The Milky Way had better watch out because the Andromeda Galaxy is zooming straight at us, on track for a head-on collision. In 4 billion years, that is. This hour, we'll talk about what happens when two galaxies collide. Will the impact destroy our solar system? Plus, the military just gave NASA a little present. Two spy telescopes, higher quality than anything NASA's ever built. We'll look at how these scopes could be used to hunt for dark energy. And that other spooky stuff, dark matter. Could there be less dark matter than we thought? Some physicists are rewriting the rules of gravity. And after a smooth ride to the space station, how soon before a SpaceX Dragon is ready to ferry astronauts into orbit? All coming up after this break. Stay with us. Hi, Ira Flatow here. You won't believe it. Something happened to our website. It got an extreme makeover. Go over to our website, have a look, and let us know what you think. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you look up in the sky at night, especially later this year, you can spot the Andromeda Galaxy. It's a small cloudy smudge in space. It's our galaxy, the Milky Way's closest galactic neighbor, about 2.5 million light years away. But if you keep watching it, yeah, go ahead, over time, keep watching it night after night. Oh, it's headed straight to us, but you're going to have to watch it for a long time because you have to crane your neck for about 4 billion years before it smacks right into the Milky Way. So how is this collision going to change our galaxy and the solar system that we live in, for that matter? Well, there'd be life on Earth 4 billion years from now. Here to talk about it is my guest, Roland van der Marl. He is an astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, and the research appears in the latest issue of the Astrophysical Journal. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Is this going to be a violent collision?
Yeah, as these things go, it probably will be. Our Milky Way and the Andromeda Galaxy are roughly equally big. Both have lots of stars in them. Each galaxy has, you know, of order, 100 billion stars in them. These galaxies are going to run into each other, and this is going to totally reshape them. So in that sense, it's going to be very violent. It's not going to be violent in the sense that individual stars will run into each other, because these galaxies have a lot of empty space in them, and most of the individual stars will actually pass by each other. So our sun will survive, but our galaxy as a whole will be totally reshaped.
So we actually have a picture on our website at sciencefriday.com of what it might look like. It's a NASA drawing. Now, aren't there black holes at the centers of galaxies? I mean, don't we know one's at the Milky Way? Is there one in Andromeda also?
Yeah, we actually know fairly certain that both of these galaxies have a black hole in their center. That's not particularly unusual. We think many or maybe all galaxies have such a supermassive black hole in their center. The one in the center of our Milky Way is about 1 million times as massive as our sun. The one in the center of Andromeda is about 10 million times as massive as our sun. When these galaxies run into each other, ultimately the black holes will slowly spiral in towards each other, and they will merge. And this will be a particularly interesting event. It'll lead to the formation of one bigger black hole, and it'll also produce what is known as gravitational radiation, gravitational waves, which astronomers have yet to detect and physicists, but we are fairly certain exist based on Einstein's theory of relativity.
Mm-hmm. And how fast is the Andromeda headed toward us?
Well, we've known for about 100 years that it's coming closer to us at a rate of about 250,000 miles an hour. Andromeda was actually the first galaxy in the universe for which it was possible to measure its relative motion. And interestingly, it was found to come towards us. We live in an expanding universe, and almost all other galaxies are moving away from us. And the reason it's moving towards us is that the Milky Way and Andromeda are particularly close and particularly massive. So even though they started out expanding away from each other when the universe was young, they've actually pulled in each other hard enough that they're falling back together. Now, what astronomers didn't know is what the sideways motion is of Andromeda with respect to us. So the velocity, you really need to know in three dimensions. The fact that the distance is getting shorter with time doesn't necessarily mean Andromeda's heading straight for us. There might be a sideways component to the motion, and that's what we've now been able to measure for the very first time.
That it's not going to slip by, it's going to hit us head on.
Indeed. Astronomers had certainly speculated it might be hitting us head on, but this was never known. If the velocity had a significant sideways component, it would have been a more elliptical orbit, and the galaxies would have missed each other and not directly collided. As it turns out from our measurement, we find that to within the accuracy with which we can measure this, Andromeda is actually heading straight in our direction. So what that means is that, there will be either a very close passage or a completely direct hit some 4 billion years from now. And then 6 billion years from now, the galaxies will merge together to form one new galaxy, which will have a very different shape than the galaxies currently have.
And what shape might that be?
Well, so today our Milky Way is a flat rotating system, sort of like a frisbee. It's spinning. And the reason the Milky Way appears to us on the sky as a luminous band of light is that we sort of see a luminous system from the side. It's a flat system. We see it from the side. It appears to us as a band. Our galaxy is also a spiral galaxy, and all of this is very similar to Andromeda. Andromeda is also a spiral galaxy. It's a flat spinning disk. When these galaxies hit each other, the stars will really be jostled about, and their orbits will be randomized. So this creates a new galaxy which has a more three-dimensional shape. It'll be what we call an elliptical galaxy, and the individual stars will not simply be rotating around in circles anymore. They will be on a wide range of possible orbits, many quite elliptical. So this galaxy will look fairly different than the galaxies look today.
A little more chaotic?
Well, actually, on the sky, we know of other elliptical galaxies in the universe around us, and we actually think this is one mechanism for forming such galaxies. Mm-hmm. On the sky, these things look fairly smooth. It just looks like a smooth sort of clump of light, sort of American football-shaped. So they don't look chaotic. The orbits certainly are more chaotic. Our Milky Way is sort of like a bigger version of our solar system. Things are just going around nicely in circles. Everything goes in the same direction. So in that sense, it's very ordered. An elliptical galaxy, some stars rotate one way, other stars rotate another way. Some stars are on very elliptical orbits. Mm. So there's a much bigger variety of things. But if you look at it from the outside, it actually looks much smoother than a spiral galaxy does, which looks fairly patchy and has these spiral patterns. Mm.
Let's go to Gary in Washington. Hi, Gary. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, I'm calling from the District of Columbia, and I wanted to know, is it not true that the Milky Way galaxy as currently constructed is the product of a collision between two galaxies that previously occurred? And I wanted to know if the guests could talk about our local group and the Andromeda supercluster.
Okay.
Sure. So our local universe is dominated by two big galaxies, that's our Milky Way and Andromeda. There are many smaller galaxies, so our local group has about 50 smaller galaxies. One or two of those are about 10% the mass of these two big galaxies. Most of them are less than 1%. So most of them, sort of in terms of gravity, don't contribute much, but, they're there. What happens, we think, one of the interesting questions in astronomy today is how galaxies form. And astronomers have come to realize that the way galaxies form is by, slowly growing, by merging with each other and getting bigger. Now, what usually happens is that you have a big galaxy that runs into a smaller galaxy. So we actually know that our Milky Way is currently in the process of accreting one or two of these smaller galaxies, and we see this happening around us. The same is happening to Andromeda. It has some evidence that it's been, eating or swallowing one or two smaller galaxies. But when that happens, it doesn't really drastically reshape the galaxy. So our Milky Way has had such events before, but since the smaller galaxies it's swallowing up don't weigh as much, it doesn't really change the structure very much. We actually know that our Milky Way has never in its lifetime run into something that was really the same size as itself. Because if that had happened, the spiral disk of our galaxy wouldn't exist anymore. If you run into another galaxy that's about as big as you are, it tends to destroy the disk of the galaxy, and it tends to make you more three-dimensional, as I described. Mm-hmm. So from the fact that we don't see this today, we know that a galaxy has never had a major run-in. We know it's had several minor run-ins, but this is going to be the first time in the lifetime of our galaxy that it's really going to have, such a major collision. We do know that this happens to other galaxies in the universe around us. We see this happening to other galaxies sometimes. But this is going to be us. Yeah. It's going to be our galaxy. It's going to be, our sun, our planet. So this is really special in that sense.
Jerry in Mitchell, South Dakota. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah. If that galaxy is coming at us at 250,000 miles an hour, why don't it just go right straight through and keep on going? Is there that much gravity that it can stop it going 250,000 miles an hour?
Good question.
Yeah, interestingly, there is. So it's going very fast, 250,000 miles an hour. That's the distance of the moon in 1 hour. On the other hand, the Andromeda galaxy is quite far away. It's 2.5 million light years away. That's why it takes 4 billion years to get here. As I mentioned, galaxies have a lot of empty space in them. So you're actually correct. When these galaxies hit each other, the individual stars will just keep going, and initially the galaxies will just come out on the other side and keep flying. However, there is a process known as dynamical friction, which will slow them down sufficiently that they then fall back together, and when that happens, they completely merge.
What happens to the dark matter that's inside these galaxies?
Well, so the dark matter, basically, the same things happen as for the stars. So these galaxies consist of stars. That's how we see them. But we actually know that at some level, the stars are just the tip of the iceberg. The stars only make up about 10% of the mass of each system, and 90% of the mass is in this matter called dark matter. The dark matter is distributed in a more, you know, spherical distribution. When these galaxies hit each other, it's not only the stars that ultimately merge to form a new galaxy. The dark matter of these galaxies will also form, merge together. So you'll end up with an elliptical galaxy, which has, you know, a big halo of dark matter around it.
Let's go to John in Wilson, Wyoming. Hi, John.
Yeah, I'm wondering if in 3.9 billion years, is the Andromeda galaxy going to take over the night sky, make it a spectacular sky, or even be visible in the daytime?
Good question, yeah.
That is a good question. When we publicized these results, we actually disseminated some animations of what the night sky might look like when this happens. And what we think will happen is that first, as Andromeda gets closer to us, it'll start, you know, look bigger on the sky. When the galaxies actually get very close together, our Milky Way will start getting distorted, but moreover, the gas in both galaxies will start getting compressed, and this actually triggers the formation of new stars. So when this hit or very close passage happens about 4 billion years from now, we expect that, you know, the sky will light up with new regions of bright star formation. Over time, though, this will die out because the gas tends to get expelled from the galaxies as supernovae go off that blow out the gas. So over time, there won't be new star formation, but in 4 billion years from now, the sky will look truly spectacular if anyone's still around to see it. And if you look around a little bit on the internet for the results of this work, you might actually find the very nice visualizations that we've put out to support this.
We have that on our website at sciencefriday.com if you want to see a nice view of the sky. Quick question, the sun will still be shining here at that time?
Yes, at the time Andromeda arrives, our sun will still be, you know, a regular star shining happily. Our sun was born about 5 billion years ago, and it has nuclear fuel left for about another 6 billion years.
There you go.
At that point, things will change drastically. But when Andromeda arrives here, our sun will still be very similar to it is today.
All right, Dr. Vandermeer, thank you very much.
Thank you, Arne.
Roland Vandermeer is an astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. We're going to take a break. We're going to still talk about dark energy, not only dark matter, and some spooky things still happening with that. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Ira here, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do, our radio show, podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, and more, if you appreciate that and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to contribute whatever you can by pressing on the donate button on your smartphone or iPad app, or going to our website at sciencefriday.com and making a tax-deductible donation. Thank you. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Our next story is about one person's garbage being another person's treasure. You know how that works. Well, this one is a very interesting story. Last year, the National Reconnaissance Office, they operate the America's spy satellites. Well, the National Reconnaissance Office called up NASA with an offer. Would NASA like a couple of old spy telescopes? We don't need them. Could you do anything useful with them? We'll give them to you. Well, of course, NASA accepted the offer, and it's a good move, as it turns out, because these hand-me-down telescopes are not merely throwaways. They are of higher quality than anything NASA ever built for space. It's not the first time this has happened. Back during the Cold War, NASA got a donation from the Air Force, 6 lightweight mirrors that were destined for military satellites, which NASA put to use in the multi-mirror telescope out there in Arizona. Well, luck strikes again. What about these new telescopes? How soon can they be put to work scanning the skies? What sort of things could we learn with them? Joining me now to talk about it are my guests, Paul Hertz, Director of Astrophysics at NASA's headquarters in Washington, Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Ernst.
Thank you very much, Ira.
You're welcome. Sean Carroll is author of the forthcoming book, The Particle at the End of the Universe, about the Higgs boson and the Large Hadron Collider. Also, he's a theoretical physicist at Caltech in Pasadena, and he joins us from there. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Paul, tell us about these spy telescopes. They're basically just dropped in your lap.
Well, yes, that's exactly what happened. They made the offer to us, told us they were available. We actually took about 6 months and studied the possibility of using them as to whether they could advance the kinds of missions that we were thinking of doing in the next decade or so. And we determined that, yes, in fact, they would allow us to do the kinds of science that had been recommended to us by the National Academy of Sciences and our other advisory groups.
Give us an idea of how they compare to the Hubble.
Well, the main difference between the Hubble is that they're much larger. I'm sorry, that they're the same size as the Hubble. My mistake. Mm-hmm. The main difference with the Hubble is that they are wide field. So if you had a camera back in the old days when cameras had exchangeable lenses, you might have had a wide field lens and a telephoto lens. The Hubble is more like a telephoto lens. It barrels in on a very small piece of the sky, whereas these telescopes are designed to look at a broader piece of the sky, a wide field view, 100 times as much sky you can see at a time as the Hubble can see.
And why are they of so much better quality than what NASA can do?
Well, they're better quality than NASA has ever needed. So that means that the mirrors have been shaped more perfectly than NASA has ever shaped a mirror before, and they also can adjust the mirrors to correct for any slight changes that happen to the telescope when it's launched. Allows you to slightly focus it even sharper after you've put it into space. And so this would give these telescopes a picture which is as sharp as the Hubble, but over 100 times as much of the sky.
Wow. Sean Carroll, does that make it more useful?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you can do different kinds of science when you have a wide field of view. Instead of picking out an object and studying it as closely as you can pick out thousands or millions of objects and really do statistical surveys to learn what the universe has been doing for the last 13.7 billion years.
What about solving some of the problems of dark energy or dark matter? Would they help?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we have dark matter and dark energy, which are two different things. Dark energy is about 73% of the total energy in the universe, and it's smoothly spread out, absolutely the same everywhere. Dark matter is about 23%. It's a particle. It falls into galaxies. That only leaves 4% for us. And we have more than enough evidence to say that these things are there. They exist. What we don't know is what exactly they are. We know some of their properties, but we'd love to get these better observations that will help us pinpoint exactly how they evolve and therefore maybe what exactly they are.
Paul Hertz, now that you've got the telescopes there, that's the easy part, isn't it? I mean, you don't have the money, you don't have the, you know, is there any plan to get them actually into space and pay for their operation and use?
Well, we don't have a plan at the moment. What we do have is a plan for making that decision. We've always been, since the last National Academy Decadal Survey recommended to us that we do a wide-field telescope as our next large mission after the James Webb Space Telescope is launched, we've been studying the possibilities of that. Now we're going to look at whether these telescopes can make that mission better, can make that mission less expensive, or can make that mission take less time to develop. So we were looking at a mission at the end of the decade, and now we'll be looking at whether these new telescopes can help us in realizing that mission.
But do you need all six of them to do that? Both of them to do that.
No, we would only think about using one of them. Using two of them would cost twice as much, and that's probably not the best use of NASA's constrained funding.
And so give us a timeline that might work out.
If we were to make the decision to use one of these telescopes in a space observatory, we would be making the decision to start sometime around the time James Webb Space Telescope launches in the 2018 timeframe. And a large telescope mission like this, like the Hubble, would take seven-ish years to build. So you'd be looking at a launch in the middle of the 20s.
Mm-hmm. Sean Carroll, let's talk about we were talking about dark energy and dark matter before. There have been studies that suggest that there's not as much dark matter in our solar system or in our galaxy, in the universe, as there should be. What do you think about that?
That's right. So the technical term for those studies was a mistake. It was found. Another paper was written by a couple of astronomers at Princeton and the Institute for Advanced Study, and they showed that, you know, it was they made an error, which made a huge sigh of relief released from all of the physicists down here on Earth who have built experiments that are trying to detect the dark matter. So we're still pretty sure the dark matter is there. Doesn't mean it'll be easy to detect, but that's still what we're trying to do.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, because some people talked about that they would have to change the laws of gravity or physics to conform if there's not that as much dark matter as they thought there should be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, dark matter is basically the most boring kind of hypothesis that would fit the data right now. It's still incredibly exciting, but there's even more exciting possibilities, like changing gravity itself. And so we'd love to know which is right and which is wrong.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Paul Hertz, what's it going to take to get, you know, you say you're going to come up with a plan to use these telescopes, but what is it going to really take in terms of lobbying to get this going?
Well, I don't think it takes that to get it going, Ira.
Yeah.
What it takes is for us to do the studies and come up with a plan and a decision that this would be the next space telescope mission that we want to do, and then to work it into our regular budget planning to use funding which we anticipate being available in our budget at the end of this decade and at the beginning of the next decade. So it just requires us to do the kind of planning for a future mission that we always do, and to then, after we've made those plans, to be talking about it with our scientific community and with our stakeholders in the government to make sure that we're all on the same page about this being the right mission to go forward with after JWST.
And what would be the prime science objective of, let's say, your first mission or your first observation?
Well, that would depend on exactly what we picked as the mission for this telescope and what instruments we put on it. Certainly one of the configurations we'll be studying will be to use these telescopes to realize the science of the Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope, which was the number one priority of the National Academy's Decadal Survey. And that telescope's prime science is to study dark energy, as Sean Carroll was just talking about, but also to detect planets around other stars, and to do a wide field survey of the science that can be realized by looking at the structure of our own Milky Way galaxy. I don't know what would be the first science that would come about when we put together an observing plan for an observatory like that. I do know that the first image we take would be breathtakingly beautiful, and we'll be excited to share it with the American people.
Are you a bit jealous of the sort of technology they get to use at the Department of Defense? I mean, these telescopes are the hand-me-downs. Imagine what they have up there that they're using.
Jealous is probably not right word. I feel very fortunate to be an inheritor of all the money and technology development they've invested in. You know, this is not a unique occurrence in astronomy. You already mentioned the mirrors that were used on the multiple mirror telescope, but all of the CCD cameras that we use both on ground-based telescopes and on space-based telescopes have heritage to detectors that were developed by the military for military purposes, and then once they're declassified, they become of use to astronomy. Also, the adaptive optics that are used in ground-based telescopes to correct for atmospheric blurring is a technology which we adapted from military uses.
Let's go to Chris in Twin Falls, Idaho. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm a former employee of the Space Telescope Project, and I'm curious that even though these military satellites might have greater optical capability, I'm really wondering how they're going to manage to do the sort of accurate pointing like Hubble, because, of course, Hubble uses guide stars, and presumably if you're looking down at the Earth, guide star locking capability is not something that they're probably using. And I'm just wondering how they would maintain the sort of accurate pointing that Hubble does. And I'll take the answer off air.
Thanks.
Well, Ira, I have no clue how spy satellites work.
Sean, you can't help us out on that one either.
Well, the good news is with a wide-field telescope, you don't need to be as accurate in your pointing.
Give us an idea. When you say wide-field, if I were looking up at the sky, what and I put my hand out, how far much of the sky would that lens, the telescope, take in?
That's probably one for Paul. It's not that much. I mean, you know, if you get half a degree on the sky, the size of the moon, that's huge for astronomical purposes. It's probably much less than that. But it's, you know, we shouldn't forget that astronomy is in the middle of a sort of a gradual revolution. When I was a grad student 20 years ago, we looked at galaxies one galaxy at a time. And when I say we, I don't mean me. I mean the people who look at galaxies. But since then, the data deluge that we've been blessed enough to be part of has absolutely changed how we do astronomy. The discovery of dark energy in 1998, the acceleration of the universe, was completely made possible by new technology that let us scan large parts of the sky over and over again. And this is just another step in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And Ira, I want to I'm going to disappoint Sean by saying that, in fact, the field of view of these telescopes is something like 1.5 degrees or larger.
Wow.
So it's 3 full moons across.
That does not disappoint me.
Sean, do you wish you had control of these telescopes?
No, nobody wishes that I had control of these telescopes, but I'm happy to propose ideas they can shoot down and occasionally interpret the new discoveries they're going to bring to me.
Yeah, well, who would and Paul, who would be controlling them once they got up there?
Well, that would be part of the plan for how we would develop and then operate telescopes like this. Right now, for the various space telescopes we have working, what we do is we set up science centers who are responsible for picking amongst the various good ideas that astronomers propose for using those telescopes, and then constructing an observing plan, and then uploading that plan to the telescope so it can be used. We have a Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, which is in charge of the Hubble Space Telescope. We have the Chandra X-ray Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is in charge of the Chandra X-ray Observatory. And we have the Spitzer Science Center out in Pasadena, California, which is in charge of the Spitzer Space Telescope.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Sean Carroll and Paul Hertz. Why not, you know, if the future of NASA is sort of jobbing out some of its work, why not just call up Elon Musk and say, hey, you know, build me a rocket to take this thing up there into outer space or into just a circular orbit? And we'll work together in private industry on this.
Wow, that was a surprising question. so, in fact, you know, when NASA builds space telescopes and missions, in fact, most all of the work is done by our partners out in industry.
Right.
The Hubble Space Telescope was built by TRW. It's operated by the Associated Universities for Research in Astronomy. The instruments were built by different university groups. So it's the common for us, after we've come up with a plan for what our space telescope is going to be, to request proposals from people who can do a great job of the various pieces and put together the best performing team that we can.
Good answer. But, you know, maybe he can do it cheaper then, or any private person might be able to do it more cheaply and quicker.
Our calls for proposals are open to all proposers.
Sean, what do you think?
Anybody who has a good idea, NASA's listening.
Sean, what would you do in for finding dark matter with this? Give me a little more specifics of how you would use it as a survey.
Well, the thing that you can do when you have a survey is sort of average over things that are going on. The wonderful thing about galaxies for astronomers is that they all have their individual little personalities. For physicists who want to know, you know, what is the basic composition of the universe, those wonderful idiosyncrasies get in the way. And what a survey lets you do is say, what were galaxies like 10 billion years ago versus 5 billion years ago versus 1 billion years ago and so forth. And then by looking at that evolution over time, you can say, well, what has the dark matter been doing? What has the dark energy been doing? And that's just the way astronomy is headed these days.
Mm-hmm. Do we have a good survey, a good number that we think that for dark matter, a confident number?
We have a confident number in how much of it there is. It's about 5 times as much dark matter as there is ordinary matter. And by ordinary matter, we mean every particle ever discovered in the history of physics. Mm-hmm. So it has to be something new. And we have this wonderful multi-pronged program for finding it. We have astronomy, like we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. We have direct detection underground, where we have big labs that are looking for dark matter particles bumping into them. And then we have the Large Hadron Collider that's trying to make the dark matter by smashing protons together and seeing what comes out.
It's possible to actually make it in the Hadron Collider?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the reasons why the Higgs boson in particular is an exciting thing to study is because the Higgs might be the single particle that connects ordinary matter to dark matter. It talks to both the electrons and the quarks that we know and love and to whatever the dark matter is.
So a Higgs boson might decay into dark matter?
That's right. And so it presents a challenge for the particle physicist because the dark matter is dark. It doesn't show up. It doesn't leave a trail in your particle detector. But they're sophisticated enough to know that there can be missing energy, that you've created a particle and you know you didn't see it. So you can talk about what its properties were, how it was created. If it is occurring in a decay of a Higgs boson in the right way, there would be really good reason to think, aha, we're on the trail of the dark matter.
Wow, that's exciting to think about. Thank you, Sean. Sean Carroll is author of the forthcoming book, The Particle at the End of the Universe, about the Higgs boson and the Large Hadron Collider. He's a theoretical physicist at Caltech in Pasadena. Paul Hertz is director of astrophysics at NASA headquarters in Washington. We'll be watching for that plan and get those space telescopes into orbit. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Ira.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, the SpaceX Dragon flew safely to the space station and back carrying a load of cargo. How soon are astronauts going to get on there? We'll have a chat to discuss that. Would you like to go? Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Speak Spanish? Ahora, Science Friday, también en español. Encuentra lo mejor de la actualidad científica hispana y del mundo en sciencefriday.com/español.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, the SpaceX Dragon capsule splashed down in the Pacific, wrapping up a glitch-free journey to the International Space Station. It was an historic first. The Dragon is really the only private spacecraft to have made the trip. This time, there was only cargo aboard, but it will not be long before astronauts are hitching rides on the Dragon. That's what SpaceX is planning for next, and they hope to have seats ready for travelers by 2015, so you can mark that in your calendar. How do you make this thing safe for astronauts? And could this private shuttle service to the space station, could that free up NASA to work on bolder ideas like going to Mars and beyond? Clara Moskowitz is a writer for Space.com here in New York. She's been reporting on the Dragon mission, and she joins us in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Were you surprised how smoothly this whole thing went? There was a little glitch at the beginning, right?
Yeah, the first launch attempt didn't go off as planned, but even that went smoothly. You know, there was a smooth abort. They looked at the problem. They fixed it. They tried again 3 days later, and from then on, I was honestly kind of shocked at how smooth it was.
How does the operation, their control center, compare to the big NASA operating center?
Yeah, it's interesting to notice the contrast. I mean, it's a much leaner team, just fewer people, you know, a lot less bureaucracy. You sort of sense this quicker operations and a sort of different atmosphere. They're kind of like excited. They feel like they're blazing this new trail.
Mm-hmm. Were there any glitches at all during the mission? Or even minor little ones?
There was a couple minor. They almost wouldn't be worth mentioning except that we have nothing else to talk about as reporters. I mean, you know, the laser navigation system had a hiccup the first time they tried to use it, but it was, they fixed it and it worked out just fine.
Mm-hmm. I remember we had Elon on the program and he was saying, you know, stowaways could go on there on this mission even though it's not equipped for people and they would survive.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing is the capsule itself would not be very different at all if there was people on board. And the way this mission went, people would have done just fine.
1-800-989-8255. In fact, there was talk, I remember reading on the internet, that when it arrived at the International Space Station and the astronauts there opened it up, they had a new car smell to the inside. Did you hear about that?
I heard that. Yeah, they have a good sense of humor up on the space station. And you could tell they were just so excited to have a new toy to play with that it had arrived. And it is different from anything that's ever been there. So I don't know if it really smelled any different, but I assume that everything just felt kind of shiny and new.
Yeah.
There are other cargo ships. The Russians have cargo ships that go up back and forth. What makes this one different from those?
The big difference is that this is the only one that can come back safely. Russia, Japan, Europe, they all have these ships that are pretty similar, except they're all designed to die on the way back to Earth and burn up in the atmosphere during reentry. And Dragon is the only one with a heat shield that allows it to withstand that reentry process.
I mean, when they put all that stuff in there to send it back to Earth, they're waving goodbye to it forever. It's going to all that garbage or whatever that's up there, they're just taking it away.
Well, they use it for that purpose, you know, on purpose. They put trash in there that they need to get rid of. So it is kind of useful to have some spacecraft that are designed to be destroyed. But they have a lot of science experiments that they want to analyze back on the ground, or hardware that went wrong that they need to look at. So this is providing a really necessary capability to do that.
You know, we never thought about that. We never think that there is science going on up there, and you'd want to bring the results back.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, some of it can be analyzed up there, you know, and you get all the data you need remotely, but there's quite a lot that needs to be taken back into a lab on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Gee, what an interesting idea. And there's room for 7 people, right? Is there a schedule for signing up, or who those people are going to be, or who decides what's happening? Are they going to be just quote-unquote, just astronauts who need to go up and back and forth to the space station? Or could they be tourists?
The cool thing is that SpaceX owns the rocket, so they can do whatever they want with it. They're not bound by any law that says you can't sell seats to whoever has enough money to pay for them. So I think that they're going to start off taking astronauts with NASA as the client, but they certainly have stated their intention to carry up tourists as well, and maybe scientists. And there's a lot of countries that don't have their own space program, but they want to send astronauts to space, so they want to hire SpaceX.
Mm. And Elon talks about going to Mars. Right.
That's right. That's right. And you know, he seems like the kind of guy to do it. That the hardware is already being worked on. You know, the heavy lift rocket is just an upgrade of the Falcon 9 that took this capsule up to space that would be able to go a little bit further to Mars.
Why was there was that little glitch at the first day of launch where the rockets ignited and shut down? Why was the turnaround time so short? You know, sometimes when NASA does something, it takes days and days to turn it around.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing. I mean, it turned out to be that a valve inside one of the rocket engines was broken, and basically that very day they sent in technicians to look up what was the problem. They found it, they replaced it, they tested it out, and they were good to go 3 days later. And I think that, I mean, it has to do with the flexibility of having that smaller team, maybe, and it has to do with the simplicity of the design of the rocket compared to a space shuttle, which is just so much more complex and harder to reach the insides of it.
Yeah, it's the most complex piece of machinery supposedly ever built.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Now, the way it docked with the space station, the robot arm had to go out and grab it, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that the normal way it would always dock? Or would it just be able to go right up there?
Once it has people on board, those people will probably do the docking by hand themselves. But this was kind of easier. They could install a totally autonomous docking system, but it's complicated and would require a lot more sort of safety precautions to make sure nothing went wrong. And it's just a lot easier to have the astronauts reach up and grab it.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Clara Moskowitz. And she's talking to us about the SpaceX Dragon. She is a writer for Space.com here in New York. This is sort of back to the future, the way rocketry is now developing, right? We're now putting people on top of a rocket instead of on the bottom, like the shuttle was built.
Yeah.
And there's the only rocket ever built for humans that did not have an escape system at the top was the space shuttle.
Right.
So there's going to be an escape system, a rocket escape system on the top of this rocket also?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, some people complain that you're kind of going back to, you know, what came before.
Back to the future.
But the space shuttle was a great vehicle. It did a lot of things, but it wasn't as safe as we wanted it to be. And it's so much safer to have the astronauts on top of the stack of rocket so that if something goes wrong below them, they can just kind of hop off in this launch escape system.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Bruce in Alexandria in Virginia. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey there.
I'm just a little bit curious, and congratulations to SpaceX on one in a row, but Atlas and Delta have been out there forever and are very reliable space vehicles. I'm just curious as to why NASA is going whole hog on SpaceX when I know that the others have the capabilities but and are also commercial and are just sort of being, as near as I can tell, left out of this?
Well, there's actually a lot of other commercial companies that are building capsules that they plan to fly on top of the Delta. So it's not that those are being completely left out. SpaceX decided to do everything in-house from top to bottom, but almost most of the other commercial companies, in fact, are just building the spacecraft and not the rocket. And those companies are still in the running to be the one that NASA goes with.
There has been a lot of fanfare about Dragon being the first private craft to make it to the space station. But in the history of spaceflight, doesn't NASA farm out all the rocket chips and things like that? That anyhow, what makes this so different?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm thinking of Lockheed, Martin Marietta, all these companies back in the history of space travel. They were there. They built the stuff. What makes this different?
The distinction is a lot more subtle than a lot of people make it out to be. Basically, in the past, NASA would buy a rocket or a spacecraft from a company like Northrop Grumman.
Right.
Now they buy services. The company retains ownership of the vehicle. So it's just almost a technicality, but it does have different repercussions for how much control NASA has.
Mm-hmm. And give us an idea of the price point, as they say. Price differential between NASA doing, let's say if NASA were going to take seven people up in the space shuttle, and and this Dragon, how much? That's got room for seven.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a SUV. I'm thinking. What's the cost difference in this?
They haven't said the exact cost per launch for the crewed vehicle, but to give you an idea, SpaceX already has a contract for $1.6 billion for 12 flights of unmanned cargo delivery services. That's going to break down to be much, much cheaper than the space shuttle's services or even Russia's Soyuz, which is how we're sending astronauts now. Those are about $60 million a seat, and SpaceX has promised to beat that for sure.
Well, if you do the little numbers quickly on the back of the envelope like here, it's sort of like $30
million. Yeah.
But
those are for the unmanned flights, so
right.
The crewed flights could be more.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Frank in San Ramon, California. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hey there.
Hi. I got a simple question just occurs to me as I listen to what you're saying. Why can't they simply slow down the speed of reentry so that heat shields aren't a concern to begin with?
Well, they do slow down the speed of reentry with parachutes and stuff as much as they can, but, I mean, there's only so much you can do when you have to go from orbital speed to nothing in a short period of time. You're just talking about plowing through so much atmosphere and dissipating so much kinetic energy that there's going to be this huge heat problem.
But Elon Musk said that he wants to land on his thrusters.
That's right.
I'm picturing the old Flash Gordon rocket that backs down, you know, comes down out of the sky backwards, lands on its fins.
Right.
Is something like that?
Yeah. I mean, it'll be a first of its kind, so who knows?
Is he the only one? Is he the only one who thinks you can do this?
He's the only one who's saying publicly that he has plans to do this. A lot of people like Blue Origin are so secretive. They keep everything so close to the cuff, and they're not really letting on what their plans are.
So there are people we don't hear much about, space competitors. Talk about those, who they are.
Yeah, there are, for sure. And partly SpaceX is out first, for sure, so that is why you hear about them more. Orbital Sciences is another company that is the other main competitor to SpaceX for the cargo ship.
Mm-hmm.
And their first launch is expected this fall, but that'll just be their very first test flight to orbit. So they are significantly behind SpaceX, but they're competing to do basically the same thing that Dragon is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a whole bunch of companies actually competing for crew. So you have Sierra Nevada, you have Boeing, which is building a capsule, the CST. You have Blue Origin.
Mm-hmm.
And so, they've had a couple rounds of this crew, but they haven't done any test flights or anything. It's a little bit farther off in the future.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow here talking with Clara Moskowitz, a writer for Space.com. What happened to the Rutans and their efforts? And are they more into tourist space than delivering cargo and going up to the space station?
Yeah, what they do is called suborbital. So
right.
It doesn't make a full orbit around the Earth. And it sounds like, oh, it's almost as good, but it's so much easier. It's such a completely different process. So the Virgin Galactic ship that Burt Rutan is building, that could never, ever go to orbit, and it could never come back. It's just not built for that. So they can take tourists up, and they can take brief science projects up because they have about 5 minutes of weightlessness. And believe it or not, you can do some good research in 5 minutes if you have everything all set to go. But it's a totally different ballgame than orbital.
Mm-hmm. A question from Andy Pritchard, and a tweet came in. What do these private spaceship projects mean for the Orion program that NASA is funding?
Yeah, the Orion is basically a version of what NASA is working on to go beyond low Earth orbit. So they want to go to asteroids and the moon and Mars. And this is also the way that suborbital to orbital is a huge step up.
Right.
Orbital to beyond low Earth orbit is another big step up. So NASA basically says we can't work on a trip to an asteroid if we are also working on sending astronauts to the space station. We just can't do it all. We need to outsource this to the private sector. And meanwhile, we'll go build ourselves a big rocket to go to asteroids.
Oh, so they say, you know, we got too much on our plate if we do all of these things. Let's subcontract the small stuff.
Exactly, because it's almost like been there, done that. I mean, NASA could build a new replacement for the space shuttle to go to orbit, but they kind of really know how to do that. They know how to do it so well that they say it should be simple enough for private companies
right.
to now do this, and they're going to tackle the next big hard thing.
Yeah, they've done this since the 60s. I mean, this is not rocket science. It's not anymore, right? This is not it's basically just knowing how to put the parts together.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. So you look at North Korea trying to do
right.
it, and it's not that easy either.
Good
you know?
Point.
So it is really hard, but to see SpaceX do it like clockwork, I mean, they're making it look easy for sure.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can go to Hugh in Oakland. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. Thanks for the program. Does this change the liability issues? I'm sure it's better for NASA if an accident happens and then it gets to the private company, but whether it's a payload or whether it's passengers, astronauts, if an accident happens, is this a liability for the private company and their insurance, or how does that work?
It's actually a thorny issue. They're still trying to work out just what the laws are going to be, because basically the private companies are saying, we can't do this if we don't have a liability shield. You know, that you just can't put that kind of liability on a private company. So there probably will be something in place, I think, to protect them to a certain degree. But you're right that certain of the dynamics are changed.
Mm-hmm. And so you think this is start of a new era now? I think we're in a new era?
I think we saw a new era May 22nd when that thing went up.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to go yourself?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Would, huh?
I would, for sure. Take me to Mars.
Well, maybe, yeah, maybe we'll see you up there someday. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you so much.
Claire Moskowitz is a writer for Space.com here in New York. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Namisha Serena Anand is our producer. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato, our production assistant. Neil Rauch, our technical director at the controls here in New York. Our iPhone app is produced by Pastime Software. Wayne Hoxie does our Android app. Thanks for listening. I'm Ira Flato.